This present window of opportunity, during which a truly peaceful and interdependent world order might be built, will not be open for too long. We are on the verge of a global transformation, and all we need is the right major crisis and the nations will accept the new world order. It's a quote by David Rockefeller, who's speaking at the UN. The US is sabotaging global disarmament. Hopes for meaningful progress towards nuclear disarmament have been shattered, particularly by the shameless grab to dominate space. That's Alice Slater, Director of Global Resources Action Centre. In searching for a new enemy to unite us, we came up with the idea that pollution, the threat of global warming, water shortages, famine and the like would fit the bill. All these dangers are caused by human intervention. The real enemy then is humanity itself. The First Global Revolution, 1991, by the Club of Rome. In the councils of government, we must guard against acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. Dwight D. Eisenhower, in his speech exposing the military-industrial complex. Welcome to Dawn's Diorama. It's Sunday the 5th of May, 2013, and my guest tonight is none other than Kyle Phillips, producer and host at themediaspeaks.com. Kyle, welcome to the show. How are you? Kyle, are you with us?
I'm sorry, my mic was on. Thank you for having me on, Dawn. I'm great.
That's no problem at all. Yeah, just remember to unmute and then we can all hear you. It's an easy
Sorry
mistake
about that.
To make. Not at all. So, I think maybe we should talk a little about you, first of all. And just like if you can go back to how you got involved in all your research and radio and whatnot, and how you got interested in research in the military-industrial complex.
Definitely. Well, I was somebody, and I always try and be as honest about who I am and who I have been in the past with everybody, so I'm not hiding anything. And I always like to start when somebody asks me that question with, I started out as a neocon. I was part of the Republican Party. I helped with campaigning on the GOP, and I loved everything that conservatives said. Radio host Sean Hannity, Rush Limbaugh, Mark Levin. But when I was 18, 19 years old, I started listening to these guys on the radio. They get me involved. I go and I start helping out with the local campaigns and the local politicians. But as I'm doing that and as I'm continuing my research, I start to realize that the ideology that Republicans claim to have of conservative ideology and what they actually do are two different things. And as I started to do more research and more research, I started to lean more down a libertarian, truther type path to where I really don't consider myself one thing at all. What I do consider myself is somebody who is addicted to researching facts.
Yeah, as a researcher or someone who likes to kind of read things, I find that myself. I agree with you there. Right, let's cut to the chase then. Can you tell us what you think is the military, what is the definition of the military-industrial complex?
Well, the military-industrial complex, the actual words military-industrial complex were never said as far as we know until that quote that you said at the beginning of the show by Dwight D. Eisenhower. That doesn't mean that the military-industrial complex didn't exist before that point, but that's the first time that we really had something to name it, something to call it. And what Dwight D. Eisenhower was referring to is a complete necessity that builds in a war society for the people who create the weapons of war, the people who utilize the weapons of war, and the people who authorize the use of those weapons all really become dependent on each other. And in my opinion, this all started right around World War II. Before that, wars before World War II, when you needed the tools of war, swords, muskets, knives, gunpowder, explosives. These things were things that could be made by anybody. You would have your swords made by the same guy who made everything else out of metal that you'd use on a daily basis. And once whatever war of the time was over, that person would go back to making whatever it was that wasn't swords, making normal things that people use. The problem is, around the time of World War II, World War I, I should say, we started seeing technologies and different weapons of wars that can't be transitioned back into society. The people who make missiles can't go and make plates and silverware after they're done. They make missiles. So what you have in something especially like a world war is a large percentage of the economy being dedicated to war. People producing war weapons, people actually using them, being involved in the military. And once that war's over, what do? 20, 30, 40, 50% of your economy disappears. So what we have in the modern industrialized world is a system where we need to continue to do less than moral things within our society to continue the economic system. And the sad thing is, most people, at least within the United States, are very much aware of this, but they just kind of accept it because they understand that war has become not only a part of our society, but a part of our economy. And that's just the beginning of it. Like we were talking about before off the air, it's kind of like a whirlpool. Starts with the people who make the weapons needing to continue to make the weapons, otherwise they have to lay off all their people. And the people in the army and in the military having to have these people continue being in the military, otherwise they're going to come back and drown out the workforce even more. And from that, you get politicians on board and politicians taking money and accepting things that aren't necessarily true to get us into military situations. And from that, it spirals all the way down through the media, through the music industry, through movies, television, until everybody within the society is an integral part of the military-industrial complex. It's an entire economic and sociological system that needs to be broken.
Yeah, absolutely. So, what do you think is the most prominent entities that comprise the military-industrial complex in the USA?
Well, the three biggest ones, in my opinion, and there's some people who might argue with me, would be the manufacturers of the weapons, the people who deploy the weapons, and the people who allow them to deploy the weapons, which would be the companies who supply things like missiles and guns and ammunition. The military, who actually uses them, and if that military isn't using those things, then we don't need to produce them, and it ruins the economic model. And then the Congress, who understands that we can't just get away from, you can't just snap your fingers and not be part of the military-industrial complex. Those people who allow this system to continue to spiral out of control. And those politicians, I might add, I have it on pretty good authority from somebody who has contacted the site, themediaspeaks.com. I can't say too much about it because it is not verified, but they have given us information saying that the people who make the weapons actually are allowed to donate millions of dollars to congressional campaigns. So you have a congressman who gets $200, $300, $400, $100 million donated to his campaign by the people making the missiles and the drones that they want to put in the Middle East. And that company serves to make billions of dollars. But what it comes down to is you're essentially giving a congressman a dime to make a dollar, and nobody else has that dime to give to make the dollar, and Congress just kind of allows it to happen. And so that's the most important aspect of it, is the Congress. Even though they may play the least violent part, they are the only key player who has the ability to get us out of this cycle.
Right. Okay. How do those behind the military-industrial complex subvert democracy and gain public support for wars and further expansion of the military?
Well, they do it in a very simple way. And I can only really speak to the American people because that's where my expertise is. I live in the United States. But in the United States, the way that it works is the American people are fully aware of the system. And we're taught from a very young age, in the most basic of economics 101 classes that you can take in a community college in this country, they tell you that war is profitable. That's like the number one rule of economics in this country, is that war is profitable. On top of that, they create enemies through the use of the media, and they get people on board with it. Just like we've done with the Middle East, just like we've done with Middle Eastern people in general who live in our country, just like we've done with illegal immigrants and the war on drugs. They create an enemy, and once you have an enemy that the general public agrees needs to be fought, all you have to do is flip the switch, and the people are on board for it. And as long as the economy isn't in complete shambles, and as long as gasoline is under $4 a gallon, people are okay with it. And people are willing to... I don't think the average person knows the full picture, but they have a general idea of what's going on, and they really prefer not to know any more than they do. Ignorance is bliss, and Americans love to be an uncarved block.
How about the problem reaction solution scenario?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, the way that it works with military industrial complexes, in most cases, which don't get me wrong, there are certain times where it is necessary to go to war. There are times in history like Mao and Stalin and Hitler and Genghis Khan, who you need to destroy these people before you destroy you. But what we have now is we create the problem, and then we create the solution to it. Not, I shouldn't even say we. Our elected representatives create a problem and a solution, and then they deliver it to us, and the American people take it on a silver platter.
Yeah, that's quite a good thorough answer you've given us. Do you think there's maybe been examples of a prototype military-industrial complex throughout history? Because when Franklin D. Roosevelt was president, businesses were enthralled by fascism and wanted to overthrow him, but the guy they picked out to succeed Franklin D. Roosevelt actually blew the whistle. So do you think it's possible that the military-industrial complex was in the works for even longer? The guy they wanted to overthrow him was actually a war hero, General Smedley Butler? Does this not open up the possibility that a prototype of the military-industrial complex, the formation of which had to be in the works for some time?
I do believe that the theology of a military-industrial complex had existed for a time before it was officially named by Eisenhower a military-industrial complex. But I think that Dwight D. Eisenhower was the person being set up to be the biggest proponent of it. And I think that in a way he kind of was. I think the only reason that he gave that speech, because that speech that he gave was at the end of his presidential term. He was pretty much retiring at that point. And I think that he realized at the end of his time what he had been a pawn within. Because if you look historically through wars, as long as there's been a photography and the ability to shoot video, any other war that you see, just Google or YouTube Dwight D. Eisenhower, World War II, and then Google any other general of any other war and see who you get the most videos of. They were setting this guy up to be the playboy, the figurehead of the military-industrial complex. And I really do think that he kind of figured it out at the last moment and just gave a little brief warning before he got out of office.
I think you've kind of answered it in a kind of roundabout way before about the how much of the GDP. I'm not asking for a specific figure here, or percentage, but I'm saying just kind of, can you give us a rough idea how much of the GDP they would be using for the defence the military, the defense budget and whatnot, how
well at this point it's
important
all
they value it.
It's the entire budget, because if you look at the entire economic system as it stands right now, the military-industrial complex is the key. Without it, the entire thing would fall apart. The media would fall apart. The job situation would fall apart. Unemployment would skyrocket. If we were to all of a sudden just say, you know what, in the United States, we're not going to have any more war anymore. We're going to pull all of our troops back home, and we're going to take those hundreds of millions of dollars that we spend on quote-unquote defense every year, and we're really going to put it into defense. We're going to put it into things not going overseas and preemptively killing people, but securing our borders so that they can't come over here and do anything to us, so we don't need to be over there to begin with. If we were to do that, what would happen? The entire part of the economy responsible for building weapons of war would just shut down. How many people would lose their jobs? And on top of that, how many soldiers would be coming back home without job experience, with soldier experience, which isn't really good in the workforce, to a country that already has too high of an unemployment rate? If they were to shut down the military-industrial complex, the entire economy would completely fall apart. So I submit that it's 100%.
Okay. Well, that's reasonable. Okay, let's go back to something you did kind of touch on it before. Hang on, bear with me here. Right, the political parties, the political process. Can you go into more detail about how do you use your power specifically to influence the political process with regards to both parties?
Well, what most people don't understand, and what they really, really need to understand, is that we don't have two political parties in the United States. We have one political party with two different faces on it. And those two parties are controlled by the same people, who are the globalists, the people who control the currency, they control the economy, they control means of production. I'm talking about Rothschilds, I'm talking about Rockefellers, I'm talking about central bankers. These people control every aspect. And when it comes to the two parties, if you look at every campaign for the past 30, 40, 50 years, the two main candidates who had a chance of becoming president in this country were funded by the same people. It's the same people giving every candidate money. So if you got money on every horse in the race, you can't really lose. So what they do is they'll put a Democrat in. And that Democrat says that he's going to do all these good things that Democrats like, but he doesn't do any of those good things. He does all of the things that the Republicans are scared a Democrat's going to do. What does that do? That makes the Republicans furious, and it makes the Democrats lose their faith in their candidate. So what happens the next election or the next election after that? Everybody's so mad at the Democrat for doing all the stuff they didn't want them to do that they vote for the Republican, who says they're going to do all the good stuff Republicans are going to say they're going to do. But once he gets into office, what does he do? He does all the things that the Democrats were scared a Republican would do. And then the cycle continues. And so you have two players, because if you have one group, people are just mad at that group, like a king, and a king gets overthrown. If you have two kings and you go back and forth between them, people just get caught up in, I'm mad at this guy for 4 or 8 years. Now I'm mad at this guy for 4 or 8 years. And then just the cycle continues. And people are falling for it, is the sad thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Now, you did touch on the Rothschilds there. Now, what's interesting is there is actually quite an interesting article on the dailypaul.com website entitled Rothschilds appear to hold shares in every major company Fortune 500. It's mentioning like corporations like Vanguard Group, State Street Corporation, Price.
Well, I mean, what is the Fortune 500? The Fortune 500 is really only like 6 or 7 mega corporations that are all the Fortune 500 are just subsidies of the mega corporations above them. I mean, our entire system, whether it be music, movies, infrastructure, industry, everything is controlled by a few banks, Disney and Fox. You know, there's not many companies once you get to the very tip of it. There's a great picture that people can find online if you look up, I think it's like six corporations that rule the world, and it shows you the main corporations in the middle, and it just spider webs out to all the micro corporations that they own underneath of themselves.
I would probably put Fidelity Investments up there as well. Rothschilds are in control of that as well. I would probably put that up there, so, because they're invested in everything from Pepsi to pharmaceuticals to, you name it, software, hardware corps, just everything, really. So, yeah, that's definitely worth looking into. And it's also one of the main shareholders of Atis, which is throwing vulnerable people off of benefits over here and forcing them into poverty.
Well, and can I just mention, too, that they've rigged the system so that even if you try and start a legitimate business and you try and go out there and make something good for yourself, the same thing happens throughout history, especially in this country, which is Wall Street gets involved. And Wall Street is completely controlled and owned by these people. So what do? Let's say that you start up a new company that makes some new piece of technology that nobody ever had before, and you're thriving, you're making millions and millions of dollars, and so you open up to the public. You allow the public to invest in your stock. So what happens is some Rothschild or some Rockefeller or some central banker comes and buys 30% of your company. And now, once you're a publicly traded company, and I give credit to this entire way of thinking to a friend of mine, Tim Dorn, who helps me with marketing, that once you open up to public trading, you no longer serve your customers. You serve your stockholders now. You will do anything you can to make your stock price increase, even if that means turning out an inferior product or screwing over the people that you're selling product to. And once you do that, you no longer own your company. You are eternally indebted to the people who own a percentage of your company until you either buy it all back, which find one company where that's ever happened, or you go bankrupt. Or you become one of them. That's the system. You don't really have a choice once you start publicly trading. And so they just completely dominate. Even if they don't own you directly, they will own you indirectly eventually.
Well, what else is relevant is obviously that kind of brings in a whole economic situation as regards the military industrial complex, like the fact that the Rothschilds set up the fractional reserve money debt system of banking, which has financially enslaved people.
It's decimated our entire economic system. If you, Dawn, come to me and you say, Kyle, I'm falling on some hard times and I need a loan. I need you to borrow me $1,000 and I only have $100. I can't loan you $1,000. I don't have it. So why can't a bank do that? Why can a bank loan you $1,000 on $100?
Yeah, it's fraud. It's based on usury. It's illegal. Well, and I guess in our terms, like if we were to do that, we would end up in jail for the rest of our life, basically. But these criminals, these crooks, these corporations are getting away with it. And they do it also, it connects to the court system as well, the legal system, the legalese, the way they use that language to trick people, and certain terminology.
And there's a difference between something being illegal and something being unlawful. You know, there's a difference between something being breaking a law and something being morally wrong to do towards other people within your society. But you're right. They've changed people's mindset on that. If you're in a jury in the United States, and let's say somebody is being tried for a crime that you don't think is a crime, somebody who got caught with some marijuana, or somebody who didn't pay their taxes, or somebody who built a shed without the proper permit in their backyard, and you don't think that they broke the law, you have the right in this country to not only vote whether they're guilty or not of breaking the law, but whether you think it's a just law for them to be indicted for. But that's not what we're told. The judge tells you, if this person did what I said they did, you vote them guilty. It doesn't matter whether you think it's right or wrong, which is not what the jury handbook says. But if you try and bring that up, there was a guy during the Oklahoma City bombing. His name was Hoppy. I forget his last name. Hoppy. He was running for governor in Oklahoma at the same shortly after he was on the jury. And he had questions about the evidence that was presented to him, and they kicked him off the jury. That's not supposed to happen. If you have questions about the evidence, they're supposed to answer those questions. But they don't want you asking questions. They just want you to say guilty.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you look at who the highest judges are and whatnot, is it any surprise, really, that they are kind of immune in the courts to any sort of prosecution, because they are running the show, basically. It's a farcical theatre which is designed to attack, or it's designed, like, when you go into court, that you're going to be found, for the most part, guilty or attacked if you're a common pair. I don't even like to use the word common, because, you know, I don't look at them as being less than them.
Right in saying that, because that's how they look at us. Let me give another example. I know, exactly. I'm a big metaphor and example guy, but I'm personally in a situation right now. I'll use myself as an example, where I live in an apartment. I've lived here for a year, and I've been reading a ton of reviews on the people that I'm renting from, and every review that I read online says that they will not give you your security deposit back when you move out. They will figure out some excuse to not give you your security deposit back. So my apartment is exactly how it looked when I moved in. We're planning on leaving it spotless. The most they'll have to do is vacuum and maybe paint, which every apartment does when somebody moves out. So when I move out, they're going to take my security deposit. But the guy who owns the building that I live in, he is in tight with everybody within the county legislation. Every election cycle, he has 3 signs up for every single person who's running for mayor, which doesn't even make sense. It doesn't really show anything. Who do you support if you have everybody sign up? But the fact of the matter is, if I try and take this guy to small claims court because he's stealing my security deposit when I move out, what are they going to say? Are they going to side with me, this random renter, even though I have pictures proving that I didn't do any damage to the apartment? Or are they going to vote for the guy who's in the city council meetings every month getting the laws changed to be in favor of him when it comes to tenant rights, and he's got one of those judges' signs up on every one of those judges' signs up around his building when it comes election time? Who are they going to find in favor of? It doesn't have to do with justice. It has to do with friendship, and I'm not their friend.
I think so, but at the same time, I think that we have a responsibility to try and make an effort to learn some of this legalese and try and get our heads round, you know, how it all works to a degree. Obviously, like, we're not lawyers, I'm not a lawyer anyway, but obviously it's years and years to kind of understand the whole, or overstand the whole kind of situation as terms of law. However, you can kind of get a grasp of the basics so that if you are ever in that situation, you know how to deal with, you know how to talk their talk, so to speak, because that's people's downfall when they don't know how to handle the court situation that's new to them, or and you know it can be actually very intimidating if you don't know how it all works.
Well, yeah, you're going into somebody else's club and you don't have a jacket, you know.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's what really comes down to. Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah. So let's get back to this military industrial complex. What is the effect of having a professional military force, you think, rather than a conscript force?
What do you mean by a conscript force? Could you define that for me?
Well, like a professional military force,
rather than like a civilian force, like a Minutemen type?
Yeah.
Well, there's pros and cons. You know, if I'll be the first to admit that if we set up our military the way that we did in the Revolutionary War, where there was no military, there was just militiamen who happen to have their AR-15s, and if they ever get called on, they go out. We would get decimated in any war that we tried to enter. Why? Because those average Minutemen people do not have the proper weapons of war. So the necessity for a defense military is there. The problem is, at least in the United States, is that we call it a defense military when what it really is an offense military. We don't protect ourselves. We preemptively go in and take out people who might be threats in the future. That is not defensive. So if we could have the same tools of war, we could have the same mechanisms and have it work properly. The problem is that we let the people who make the weapons have too much say in how they get used. The people who make the weapons, I don't think that we should have companies that solely make weapons. We should have companies like we did back in the Middle Ages. You have the iron worker who sits there and pounds out whatever it is, pots, pans, and when there's a war, he makes swords. That's what we need to get back to. We don't need companies that specialize in military. We don't need Tony Stark.
Yeah. There's clearly something very wrong when a lot of people are being pushed into poverty, can't afford to feed themselves, are unemployed, and unemployment's rising, the figures are being juggled, and obviously it's a lot worse than they're actually saying that it is. There's something clearly wrong when you look at that and you look at how much they're spending on the defense.
Well, and that just plays back into it, too, because like you said, you have people in poverty, you have people without jobs who can't afford their bills, you can't afford to even have a basic apartment to live in. And so what do those people do? Especially when you have people who, you know, that's their dad. Their dad is that guy who hasn't been able to find a job for 20 years and they live in a rundown place because they don't have any money. And that kid sees that as his future. And then they have a military recruiter in the high school when he's 16 years old. What do you think that kid's going to do? Is there another choice? If he wants to be in the slightest bit successful in his life, they push kids into it at an age when they have no idea what they're doing, and you really don't have any other choice for a lot of people. I know a ton of people who completely disagree with the military. They don't like what they're doing, yet they're still in the military because that's their paycheck.
Yeah, I mean, it basically, all these wars are illegal wars. They're based on fraudulent reasoning. I suppose we could go into that. Could open a whole lot of rabbit holes here if we could go into that, but I think we'll maybe kind of stay away from that at the moment. So what would be the effect of having non-state military forces?
Like not having a federal military?
Yeah.
Well, and that's one thing, is I will say, and a lot of people will probably disagree with me on this, but I do think that we need a federal military. I do think that there is a place for it, but I do not think it's the place that it's holding right now. Because you can have the military exist where it could be running on one quarter of the budget, and we could be doing things like Ronald Reagan. Say what you will about the guy, but he at least took a step towards a defensive military with the Star Wars defense system. A lot of people don't think it exists. It's kind of speculatory whether it does. If anybody doesn't know what I'm talking about, it's a set of satellites that allegedly orbit the planet, and if anybody was to ever shoot a nuclear missile or anything at the United States, we could shoot it out of the sky with a laser beam. That's the kind of stuff that we need to be working on. If we had a good enough defense parameter, we could have those same industrial elements creating defense mechanisms instead of creating offensive weaponry. And the system could still work. And I do that you need that federal military, because if we had, hypothetically, you know, boats showing up on the shores of California or Florida, militiamen are not enough compared to RPGs, you know, and tanks. You need to have those things, but we don't need to have 80% of them in the Middle East.
Yeah. There's been a lot of oppressive bills been passed recently in America, like the NDAA and the Patriot Act. Do you want to talk a little bit about them?
Oh, well, I mean, that's the post 9/11 America as we've been taught to accept it, is that since 9/11, we were attacked, and so now you have to give up all your rights to be safe. And most Americans just accept that. Most Americans say, okay, you can read my email so that a bomb doesn't land in New York or something like that. But what people don't realize is that things like the NDAA and the Patriot Act and CISPA trying to watch your emails, they don't really protect us against anything. We haven't seen really any evidence that we've had any quote-unquote terrorist attacks stopped by any of this legislation. But it's fear-mongering. It's fear-mongering in people into accepting something that they would have never accepted in years prior.
Yeah, in the name of, inverted commas, in the name of security, you're basically giving up your rights. It's a con.
Well, exactly, and a lot of people just buy into that, and they're like, okay, I got to give up my rights for safety, but they don't understand that they're not really getting anything in return, they're just giving.
No, I mean, like the TSA, and especially in America, and their hands down people's pants and whatnot, and there's body scanners, naked body scanners. And cancer machines, basically.
They're talking about putting TSA in arenas and stuff. They want to put them in NFL games, football games, baseball games, because there might be a terrorist threat there, even though there's never been one before.
Oh, Kyle, you got a little bit. I could hear what you were saying, but there's a little bit of interference there. I don't know if you were too close to the mic or something.
I'm sorry, can you hear me better now?
I can hear what you're saying. It was a bit kind of choppy. I don't know what's causing it.
Here, let me play with my mic really quickly. I apologize.
That's all right. So, what would be the realistic United States economic outlook if the world stopped fighting tomorrow?
Like, what would we do if we just ended all the wars, pulled out of the Middle East, pulled all of our military out of everybody else's countries?
Mm.
We would be destroyed. Absolutely. 100%. The United States would be destroyed. Why? Because we've let this go on too long, and we've already made too many people mad. You can't go back once you've already made everybody vengeful.
Yeah. So, okay. What are reasonable solutions to the excessive power of the military-industrial complex, then?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that question? My mic kind of cut out, or my speakers.
Sure. What are reasonable solutions to the excessive power of the military-industrial complex?
Well, it's a progression. It would have to be done slowly. We would have to slowly start pulling our troops out of other countries and replacing them, because keep in mind that if we're pulling troops out of countries, that's a lot of money that we're going to be saving, millions and millions of dollars. We would have to take all of our troops out of foreign countries, and then we would have to replace that monetary deficit that was causing us with rebuilding their countries, which a lot of people don't like the idea that why are we spending money on other countries? But at this point, we don't really have a choice, because we've ruined other people's countries. We've destroyed democracies and we've put in dictatorships. We've destroyed countries that were working perfectly fine and had a good system before we got in there. So we would not only have to pull everybody out, but we would have to fix all the problems that we caused, because if we were to pull everybody out of and don't get me wrong, I do. We've talked about this on the false flag episode that I was on. I do believe that the government played a role in most of the terrorist attacks that we've seen from 9/11, including 9/11. But if we were to pull out now, you better believe that we're going to see more terrorist attacks, that's going to come right back at us. We've offended these people. We've ruined their homes. If somebody did that to us, we would attack them. So it has to be a combination of stopping the aggressiveness and at the same time rebuilding the countries that we've destroyed. And that is an expensive and difficult endeavor.
So would your answer to this question be kind of similar? What happens when the United States runs out of third world countries to fire missiles at?
Well, I don't think that'll ever happen. I mean, if you look, historically, the Middle East is just the place to do it. And the thing that really scares me about that is while the Middle East is the place to fight endless, useless wars to support military-industrial complexes, historically, it's also the places that those same countries go to die. So I really don't know. I look at it from a different perspective that I think we're too far down the hole. I think the only answer at this point, honestly, is complete nullification of the United States government.
Right. So, well, in your opinion, the United States ought for total systemic collapse or for to finish its empire with total war?
Oh, no, that's absolutely what we're headed for. There, Adam Kokesh said on his podcast a few days ago that there was a poll done where I believe it was, and I might be wrong on this, but I believe it was 26 or 27% of Americans, when polled, said that they think there is a possibility that within the next 2 to 3 years we will be forced to take up arms against our own government. That is a ridiculous percentage of people to be saying that. I mean, when you ask a question like that, you should be looking for 1 or 2% coming back. 27%, even if you go down to 15%, it was 5, 10% of people who started the American Revolution. That is not a good sign, and it's a warning sign of a complete collapse or a revolution.
So what's your thoughts on Department of Homeland Security and FEMA?
They need to be rid of completely. But the thing with FEMA, and this was something that I meant to say before, but it's a point that needs to definitely be heard, is that people talk about FEMA camps a lot, and there's a lot of argument, do FEMA camps exist? Are those what people are, because we have pictures of them, but are those really FEMA camps? Are they really what those conspiracy theorists think that they are? Whether you think they are or not, look at the United States right now. I think it's like in the 40s, 40-something percent of Americans are on some sort of public aid. A huge percentage of people in this country have food stamps. They have Section 8 housing, which means the government pays for their house. They have complete tax exemption. In fact, the people who have all these benefits, I was talking to one recently who is somebody who has a family. He truly needs these benefits, and he doesn't abuse them. And he was offended at the fact that he was getting $9,000 back on his tax return when he only paid like $2,000 in. So they're getting people hooked on the system. So I submit that it doesn't matter whether FEMA camps are real, because Section 8 housing is FEMA camps. We're already in them.
Yeah. I mean, it is a kind of like, I suppose it depends on your perspective, but yeah, it's kind of like a ever-unfolding police state, prison planet, isn't it?
Well, exactly. And it's like you don't have a choice to get out. Once you're in the section, you live in the Section 8 housing. You have the food stamps. You have all the government subsidies. You have the Obama phone, as it's been come to called. Everything that you have, all of your necessities are supplied by government. What's your other option? You can go get a job, right? And even if you do find a job that's going to pay you well enough, you're going to be working 40 hours a week now for the exact same living standard that you have. So people have no benefit to get out of it. So you don't need to lock the doors on the FEMA camp. People aren't looking to leave.
I think that it's like we're not as such in a prison as more people are in a prison. Well, I can't really speak for other people, but there's a prison within our minds, basically, and it all depends on how you manage that, how you knowledge is power, basically. Knowledge and reading and learning what really is going on in the world and critically thinking cannot emphasize how important that is, really, to because society, I mean, because the way the schools are built, there's deliberately discourage critical thinking. And you need critical thinking to be able to examine like the information you're being given and find out whether it is.
Yeah, schools teach you to memorize.
Yeah, whether it's credible or not to look into it properly.
Rather than just swallowing everything
that you're told.
Yeah, I had a teacher in high school where somebody it was an art teacher. He taught like graphics for like Photoshop and all that. And somebody in class one day randomly asked him. And this guy was a pretty cool guy. They asked him out of nowhere, like, what do you think is wrong with like the public education system? This guy stopped class. He stood up. Got up to the chalkboard, which was never used because this was a computer class, and he went on for about an hour about exactly what you're saying. And this is somebody who works within the system, so he knows that they don't teach you critical thinking. They don't teach you to analyze situations. They teach you to memorize answers, and that doesn't make entrepreneurs. That doesn't make innovators. That doesn't make inventors. That makes button pushers. That makes cubicle workers.
Yeah.
That's what
they're training you to be a compliance slave, and what you need to know to work in your box, basically what your specific job is, that and no more. They don't want people to think critically and see the bigger picture, really. But unfortunately, they don't really have any control over that, because a lot of people can see the bigger picture, and it's increasing. The numbers of people that can see the bigger picture is increasing all the time. And many people that are aware anyway, but they're kind of like in a state of cognitive dissonance that seems to be, unfortunately.
Well, yeah, you get a lot of people who it's not that they're incapable of breaking out of the mold and understanding what's going on. It's that they have no intention of doing so. It's like I had a conversation with my mom, because my mom is a Lutheran, and she said to me something along, "You're a Lutheran." And I said, "No, I'm not a Lutheran." And she said, "Yes, you are. You were raised a Lutheran." And I looked at her and I said, "What's the difference between a Lutheran and a Baptist?" And she didn't know, and she had no intention of finding out. She just wanted to get mad and continue to accept that she was a Lutheran. And I'm not saying anything bad about Christians. Don't think that I'm saying that. What I'm trying to say is that you have that same mentality of, if you try and bring these things up to the average person, it's not that they're incapable of understanding them. It's that they don't want to. They're happy where they are.
I kind of get that, but yeah, I mean, I just think totally different. I want to know, you know. I can't go back now. I mean, don't get me wrong, I am no way an expert on subjects or whatever. I like to learn though, and I can't ever go back to the state of ignorance that I had before.
Well, but that's because you've been woken up, and I'm talking about people who haven't been woken up at all, because what you're saying is exactly right as well. And everybody who is woken up, truther, whatever you want to say, they all have that friend who tried to say at one point, like, "I'm done, I'm tired of this, I don't want to learn anymore, I just want to go be my uncarved block," and you can't do it. Once you've been woken up, there's no going back to sleep. You're an insomniac.
But don't you feel that the more you know, the less you know? The more you become aware of, the less you really know. What you know is just a tip of the iceberg, really. So I think that I have problems with the whole term waking up, because we don't really know that much. I don't believe we know that much.
Right. You're right. It's the more that you learn, the more you know, you don't know shit. You know, you figure out really quickly that there's just, you start learning about one thing, and then you start seeing more names, and you start looking into those names, and there's even more things. I could sit and read 100 books a day and still not know anything.
Yes. We could go into how they're doing the psyops, the monarch mind control, and everything, all the different forms of mind control, but I suppose that would take another show. So we won't. Do you think the United States would attempt to keep its government and military afloat by taxing other countries, similar to how they tax food worldwide with Monsanto?
I don't think that the United States in itself will ever go and directly tax another country. What I do think they'll do is they will suck the country beneath them dry. They will take all of our money. They will completely bankrupt the system, and then they will turn to the UN to do that for them.
Okay, so how do you see this, the problem 20 years into the future, so in terms of the military-industrial complex and whatnot?
Well, you know, I'm really on the fence. And I've said this, I think, at least once or twice already. It can really go one of two ways, and there's so many different factors that can play into it, and one of the big ones, the biggest one, is the internet. It really depends on what we see happen with the internet in the next few years, if they do get dominance over it, if they do gain control over it, which they are very, very much trying to do, then they'll be able to censor people. They'll be able to control the flow of information, because that's how they've been working up until this point. Up until the internet was invented, founded, I guess you could say. I don't think it wasn't. It could be invented. They were able to control everything. The only information that you got was from a newspaper, a TV, or a radio. But now that it's out there everywhere, I think that you can see a flip in consciousness. It's impossible to go on Facebook without finding some information pertaining.
And that's why they've brought in this CISPA, but that's why they're really pushing to try and censor the web, because they can see that they've made a mistake there by allowing people to have access to this. Well, maybe not allow necessarily that they want to stop us having access, but they want to control the information that is accessible by us on the web, because they want to control, obviously, what we learn about. And the internet is full of, it's full of shite, and it's full of, it's got some good information as well. And it's a case of really taking the time to dig through the information, and Paul got a dodgy throat. So, how would Western society look if the military-industrial complex never hard. I kind of asked you that before, though, didn't I?
If it never existed to begin with, it's tough to say, because it dominates so many aspects of our life. I mean, for all I know, if it never existed, we could still. We could not even have electricity right now. It makes me think of, I saw online a few days ago, it was a quote from a Native American from the time of American settlers coming over. He was somebody who had lived through the Revolutionary War and seen the early years of the United States. And an American came and asked him, if the British coming over here and starting up the United States could have done things differently, what would you say they should have done? And this Indian, or Native American, I apologize, this Native American chief said, and I'm paraphrasing terribly, but he said, before the white people came over here and took over this country, there was plenty of food everywhere.
I'm really sorry, I need to cut you short because we're running out of time. Okay. But I'll have you back on in the future and you can finish what you want to say. Thanks for joining us. Kyle's from the mediaspeaks.com. This was Don's Diorama, and over and out. Good night, everybody. Thanks for tuning in.